Coming up on Tech News Today, did Windows bring back the start button? Iaz is going to make this whole thing clear for us. Apple's ditching Foxconn, and Motorola's new phone is Texas built. Howdy, Moto. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, May 30th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Tonks Coffee. Tonks offers a bi-weekly subscription. Tonks sources their beans directly from the growers. They're roasted and shipped within 24 hours, giving you the freshest coffee beans in the world. For a free sample, visit tonks.org/TNT. That's TONX.org/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Iaz Akhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we try to keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, put them in context for you, starting each time at the top 10 stories of the day in the news feed. Microsoft posted official details about Windows 8.1 today. The start tip will now look like the Windows logo and will always be visible on the desktop. In other words, Microsoft just can't bring itself to say they brought the start button back. Users will also get the option to boot straight to the desktop, integration of SkyDrive even when offline, and resizable panes when running two apps from the tiled interface. Oh, and resizable tiles as well. A preview of Windows 8.1 will arrive at the Build Developers Conference in San Francisco on June 26th.
Motorola wants you to get excited about its new Made in the U.S. smartphone. Yeah, Motorola is going to make a comeback in that high-end mobile market after losing share to Apple and Samsung since being acquired by Google in 2012. The new phone, called the Moto X, will be built at a 500,000-square-foot facility in Texas and will employ 2,000 people by August.
Samsung revealed the Samsung Galaxy S4 Mini. Because this is a mini phone, it has a teeny tiny 4.3-inch screen, not an enormous 5-inch one like the regular S4. It also has mini storage with 8 gigabytes of space. 5 gigabytes are for the user, so get yourself a micro SD card. The processor in the Mini is a 1.7 gigahertz dual-core processor. The regular S4 has a quad-core. The S4 Mini is going to run Android 4.2.2 and is going to launch officially at Samsung's June 20th event.
Wait, everybody, Apple released a new product. This is it. It's an iPod Touch, but hey, new product. Okay, it's kind of just a 16-gigabyte version of the 5th-gen iPod Touch, which was only available in 32-gigabyte, 64-gigabyte models before. But the newish 16-gigabyte iPod Touch has a 4-inch Retina display, dual-core A5 processor, and a front-facing FaceTime HD camera. Sells for $229.
Pegatron already makes iPhones and iPad minis, and now the Wall Street Journal is reporting it will be crowned primary assembler of that low-cost iPhone expected later this year. The shift is apparently also due to longtime Apple manufacturing partner Foxconn's production troubles with the iPhone 5 because, as an unnamed Foxconn executive tells the Journal, the handset is the most difficult device that Foxconn has ever assembled. Good thing Pegatron is a robot Pegasus and can probably handle it.
Good thing.
Pegatron.
Social traffic app Waze just got a little bit more social. The new Waze version 3.7 for iOS and Android will populate its destination list with Facebook events. That is, assuming you have it connected to Facebook. If an event is missing an address and a Waze user inputs that address, the info will become available to everyone else invited to that Facebook event. Waze is also touting a feature that lets you track your friend's arrival on a map so you can all arrive at that party together.
European Commission Vice President Neelie Kroes delivered a new plan to the European Parliament today that would end mobile roaming and guarantee net neutrality in Europe. Package aims to create a single Europe-wide telecoms market by next year. Kroes hopes to have the package signed and presented by Easter 2014.
Ah, the rumors, they be true. That's my pirate. Arr. On stage at the D conference, Sundar Pichai showed a brand new HTC One that runs on an untouched stock version of the Android OS. It'll be available from the Google Play Store starting on June 26th for $599. The unlocked device has 32 gigabytes of storage, will run on both AT&T and T-Mobile's LTE in the U.S., and Google will be directly handling future software updates. Pachai also promised that Google Play Music will be coming to iOS in just a few weeks.
Broadcom introduced two new chips aimed at the Internet of Things. The BCM20732 Bluetooth smart system on a chip would connect accessories like heart monitors, pedometers, and door locks to Android smartphones and run off a coin cell battery for more than a year. The BCM4390 Wi-Fi system on a chip does pretty much the same thing, but with Wi-Fi instead of Bluetooth. Bluetooth chip is in full production now, and the Wi-Fi version will reach full production by Q4.
Evernote has just introduced some new security features. First up is two-step verification that's being rolled out first to premium users. Evernote also introduced accessed history, which will let a user see when Evernote has been used in the past 30 days. There's also a listing of authorized apps, so you can see what apps are linked to your Evernote account. The access history feature and app listings feature go live today for all users. Wait a second. I just said Evernote four times. I think that summons Rafe Needleman. Or is that five times?
Huh?
Hello.
I wasn't sure exactly when that was happening. How's it going, Rafe?
It's great. Thanks for the reviving the Evernote drinking game. It's good to see you guys.
All right, we'll properly introduce Rafe Needleman in just a moment, but first want to thank our sponsor for today's show, Tonks Coffee. Sarah, you've been brewing some Tonks Coffee at home.
Yeah, you know, I'd love to show you the fancy little Tonks shipment that I got, but I've already taken it home and I've already busted it open, and I made quite a bit of Tonks Coffee over the weekend, and I have to say, it was delicious. Tonks is a small company made up of experts, coffee experts. Everyone knows a coffee expert. Tonks happens to employ quite a few of them, who believe that we can all have great cups of coffee, and it doesn't mean that we have to pay, you know, $5 for a cup at some artisanal coffee shop that, you know, we have to drive to get to and wait in line for an hour. None of that stuff. It's all about quality beans. And that's what Tonks does. Tonks sources their beans directly from growers. Then they roast the beans. And then they ship those beans within 24 hours of roasting so that you get the beans fresh. It's a bi-weekly subscription service with Tonks. So, you know, you drink a lot of coffee. By the time you're out of coffee, you get another shipment of the next batch of coffee. You can be sure that it's going to be fresh. You can be sure that it's not going to have been sitting on some shelf in some store getting stale. Homebrewed coffee can be just as good as the best cafe in your town. It's not about really anything except having great beans. And since the Tonks folks are so good at coffee, on their website, if you go to tonks.org/TNT, got some kind of helpful tricks about how to get the most out of your beans at home. But really, it's it's best brewing methods and equipment is part of it. But again, it's that coffee. It's convenient. Like I said, bi-weekly subscription brings those beans right to your door. You really never have to think about it again, and you're going to save a lot of money. Cafe visits, they add up. Tonks Coffee also makes a fantastic gift. So even if you're not a coffee drinker, you probably know somebody who would really love something like this. If you're looking for a hard-to-buy four-person, there are birthdays coming up, why not get them a great cup of coffee every morning? I mean, nothing says I love you like coffee, says the girl who drinks a lot of coffee. A lot more meaningful than a gift card. Go to tonks.org/TNT. Every 2 weeks, you get the new batch of incredible beans roasted to perfection. Subscription, offering a free sample to our viewers and our listeners, tonks.org/TNT to get some for yourself. And thanks to Tonks for sponsoring this episode of Tech News Today.
My Tonks coffee is the only one that really understands me, Sarah, to be honest.
Oh, my goodness. That is a lonely life you lead.
That's going to make a really interesting show then.
Oh, wow. This just got real.
Let's give a proper welcome to Mr. Rafe Needleman, Director of Developer Relations at Evernote, hence the summoning of him during the news fuse. Welcome back to the show, Rafe. Of course, longtime co-host on Buzz Out Loud and Real Deal back in the CNET days. Good to have you back, man.
It's good to be here. Good to see you guys.
Thanks for joining us. Sure. Let's start off by talking a little bit about Windows 8.1. There are lots of varying headlines about whether they have brought the start button back or not. Ayaz, can you put this controversy to rest?
Probably not, but let's talk about it. So Windows 8.1 got official. Microsoft's got a huge blog post about it. There is a start button on the desktop. No, it does not bring back the start menu. When you click the flag, it brings you to that start screen with the giant tiles that you're used to. Now, the start button on the desktop replaces that little sliver that used to be in the bottom left corner. That's what some people call the start tip. The button will not appear on Windows 8 applications, those full screen ones, the Metro, that's the old style, unless you hover on the bottom left corner. So you can actually bring up that little flag button. It's going to be enabled by default. You're going to have a Windows flag on your desktop, and it will bring you to that start menu. But you can also configure the start button to go to a brand new section called All Apps, which can be sorted by different views, and it makes it kind of look like the traditional start menu. So you can make it look like the old one, but not really. So that's all about the start button alone. Then there's other stuff. You know, Windows 8.1 is more than a button. There's an option to boot straight to the desktop. There's a simple change that lets you have the same wallpaper on the desktop and the start screen. So when you hit that start button, the tiles kind of fly in over your desktop, so it kind of looks more consistent. Some lock screen changes. You can accept Skype and voice calls and take photos without unlocking the device. Start screen changes. You've got different size tiles. Search now also is powered by Bing, so it's going to have a totally different style of search. Snap, the feature that lets you have multiple applications, is more powerful now. You can do up to 4 apps at once. The Snap supports a 50-50 split, 60-40 split, 80-20 split, and obviously 4 if you have enough resolution on your screen. A lot more SkyDrive integration, updated PC settings, so you don't need to go to control panel. But Microsoft didn't say when this is going to ship, but they will show it off at the Build conference on June 26th. Rafe, is this update going to finally silence all of the Windows 8 naysayers?
Oh, no. I mean, of course not, because we love to say nay to Windows. But I think the biggest deal is the return of the desktop, a boot to desktop. That should mollify all the IT directors who said, I do not want this thing here. It's a new platform. It's a new system, and it's too hard to teach, and I just don't want to deal with the confusion. At least now they'll be able to configure Windows. So when you turn it on, you go to what looks like a standard application screen with a standard background. Backdrop and icons and access to all the standard apps that people are used to. That, to me, is the biggest change and the biggest withdrawal from the position that, hey, this is a whole new thing, one user interface to rule them all. That didn't work, so they have to bring back the desktop.
Tom, what do you think about this whole start button? Sort of back, not really back, but kind of there.
I guess it's nice to have that button persistent on the desktop. That really hasn't bothered me all that much. I missed the start menu, and they're not bringing that back. And this all apps menu is improved over what it was before, but it's not the start menu. I've gotten used to Windows 8 the way it was, so this really doesn't make much difference to me. I'm more excited about the idea of having SkyDrive integration so that I could just save to SkyDrive and it will sync across all my different Windows 8 devices. That's pretty intriguing. That's pretty cool. I do like the fact that you can resize the panes if you are in that tiled interface. I never use multiple applications in the tiled interface because of that. So that might make me at least experiment with it. And I was talking with some folks in the chat room. We've seen some leaked versions that are running more than 2 apps in that tiled interface at once. So that would be cool if that makes it into the final build, but I couldn't find any confirmation about that. All in all, I think these are all smart tweaks that do show that Microsoft's paying attention to what people want.
Yeah, that is the Snap feature. There will be up to 4 applications available on your screen at one time if your display has a high enough DPI and resolution. I believe The Verge saw it on a pretty high resolution Toshiba display. So I believe that's going to be an 8.1.
Has Microsoft confirmed that? That's what I couldn't find. Did you find Microsoft?
Microsoft did show in their blog post multiple. I think they had 3 applications up at once in the Snap feature. But this reminds me of the ads that Microsoft is running, saying it can do more than an iPad. It's snapping 4 applications at once. Sarah, do you think that people are going to accept Windows 8.1 more than they did 8?
Well, yeah, it's better. I mean, I think that there's some concessions that Microsoft made, but, you know, people were a little bit confused. There were certain things about Windows 8 that didn't make sense. So let's give you more options. When you were running down some of the ways that the start menu sort of works and doesn't work, my head is kind of reeling and I'm saying it's just more confusion. But again, I think it's going to make a lot of people happy who are just like, hey, wait a second. I want a little bit more of the Windows interface that I'm just used to. So that's fine. But yeah, as Tom said, it's the stuff that's that's new, that's the exciting stuff. There's SkyDrive integration, there's these Snap features, there's the ability for people, if you've got a nice monitor, and many people do, to make the most of it. So, yeah, it's a step in the right direction.
There's also this really cool feature. I like this one for Windows 8.1. When you download apps in Windows Store, it doesn't automatically go to the start screen. That's what the default is right now in 8. So you can have this really long start screen where you're just flicking and flicking and flicking for applications that you might not even want. So now they go into these all applications folder, which you can pin to that start menu if you want. So it makes it a little cleaner. I think the big thing, and this is the silliest thing, by having the desktop wallpaper be the same as the start menu, the start screen, I think that's going to ease a lot of people's minds. When they hit that button, they're not like, where am I now? They just have this idea that it's
the perception that you're still in the same place.
Right.
I agree.
This overlay. Yeah. I think that's the smallest change that's going to make the biggest difference.
Well, sometimes those user experience, those tiny little things that don't seem like much really are. You know, just as far as navigation goes.
Totally.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that caused people to say, I hate the new start menu, is that little difference.
Where
right
am
there.
I going? Just want to start.
I'm in outer space.
If you want more discussion of Windows 8.1, definitely check out Windows Weekly. It's on demand at twit.tv. Also, if you're watching live right after this show today. Let's move on to Apple and their new iPod Touch, as well as this report about Pegatron.
Yeah, so 16 gigabyte iPod Touch model is now available in the online store. So it's a 4-inch Retina display. It's got the dual core A5 processor, has a front facing FaceTime HD camera. So it looks just like that iPhone, except that there is no rear facing cam. So the fifth generation iPod Touch originally was 32 gigabytes or 64 gigabytes. Apple, at the same time, was selling the 16-gigabyte and 32 variants of the fourth-gen model. So this is basically a smaller storage, souped-up version of the iPod Touch. It's available to order now for $229. You've got a single black and silver design. And Apple says once you order, you'll get it in 24 hours. Ayaz, you've been using the iPod Touch is your primary kind of phone, I guess, if you could even...
Yeah, for a while.
Yeah, use it as a replacement. Does this appeal to you? When I first read this, I was like, well, it's, you know, the storage is cut in half. It's a little bit, you know, snappier, but who's the target market for this?
I think this is just to get... this device is for the hands of children, effectively, at this point, because it took out that camera. It's not like they've added any radios into it. It's not like it's an LTE device like an iPad or something like that. It just seems like Apple wanted to unify their production lines. They're no longer employing that 3.5-inch screen on their devices. The iPhone itself is 4 inches now. So to have all the devices have this uniform size will probably also help with iOS 7 because these applications are going to be written, and the OS itself is going to be written for a 4-inch display. So perhaps Apple just wants to unify that. But this device itself is probably for appealing to people who want an entry-level iPod. Mm-hmm. But the lack of camera, I do find a little surprising, but that's probably what's keeping the price so low.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do when you're trying to take over a market, is you want a wall of products every X dollars. And, Apple has always done this with the iPods. They have product every $40 or $50. So, you know, no matter what your budget is, no matter how much you think your kid is worth, it's like, oh, I'll get that one. If you leave a gap there, then somebody else can come in. And that's not a good thing. So it's a standard strategy. And, you know, you're right. They do need to kind of unify the production and move as they move to iOS 7. But it doesn't seem like that big a deal to me. And again, the lack of the back camera, you're right, just lower cost so they can afford to do it at $229.
It does. I mean, it really does cut out quite a few of the great iOS apps that are, you know, camera photo editing software. Sure, you could use your front-facing camera, but, you know, it's not as good as the rear-facing camera on, you know, the iPhone equivalent models.
Some Kickstarter project will come out with a mirror that bends the light around so it can turn it into a back-facing
camera.
Yeah,
exactly. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Pegatron is going to sort of become Apple's right-hand manufacturing man, primary assembler of this lower-cost iPhone that is reportedly going to be a real thing later this year. Pegatron is already making iDevices, so they certainly are already working with Apple. There are rumors that Pegatron is planning to hire a huge number of folks for their workforce based in China. up to 40% during the second half of this year. So again, it's kind of where these rumors come from. And then CEO Tim Cook is not getting away from Foxconn completely, but wants to achieve greater balance in the company's supply chain by shifting more work to Pegatron. And there have been reports that that Foxconn has had issues making that iPhone 5. Tom, do you think that this just makes sense for Apple not to be too reliant on any one company, especially given Foxconn's somewhat sketchy past?
Yeah, you don't want all of your eggs in one basket. That's a metaphor. And Tim, don't forget, Tim Cook was the supply chain master under Steve Jobs. He knows what danger signs to look for and what to do. So this is probably a very good idea for Apple to diversify the supply chain and possibly get some efficiencies and cost savings by moving to Pegatron, making sure that you're not risking your entire supply chain if Foxconn has an issue.
You know, one of the things that kind of I found really interesting about this, I mean, obviously, diversifying the supply chain is good when you run into an issue, whether it's a cost issue or a public relations issue or, you know, humanitarian issue like you did with Foxconn. You want to be able to move your production elsewhere, either the threat of it or really just move it, so it's good to have Pegatron spun up to take on production. But one of the things that I found most interesting about the reports that I read is Pegatron, the news that Pegatron underbid Foxconn for production of some products like this reported low-end iPhone. And if you underbid Foxconn for production in China, I mean, where is that savings going to come from? I mean, you just have to ask. So I don't think that moving to Pegatron necessarily solves the humanitarian issues that have plagued Apple with Foxconn so far.
Well, possibly.
Well, it may or may not. It's a good point.
Is it possible that Pegatron actually has a better manufacturing process compared to Foxconn? Because that's part of the cost issue. Foxconn said it was very difficult to build the iPhone. So unless Pegatron's got a different way to do it, maybe that'll allay the concerns of human rights.
And don't forget that the profit margin pressure is what Apple is feeling most and having to explain to stockholders. So it's not a surprise that they would seek around for a better price from their suppliers as well. And they've promised to at least create one Mac in the United States. And that's probably not going to be the cheapest way to go, but it's going to be one of the best ways to go. Speaking of moving things to the United States, Motorola is going to be building a phone in Texas. Dennis Woodside announced this at All Things DIS.
Yeah, Dennis Woodside just deciding to announce the Moto X. He confirmed the name. This will be their flagship hero phone. He said the device is going to be broadly distributed across carriers. He focused on what Motorola does well as a company, and he was saying that's managing power and managing ultra-low power sensors. And he's saying that the Moto X is going to use these sensors and this technology to be contextually aware. So as an example, Woodside said, if you're in a car going 60 miles an hour, this phone is going to act differently so you can interact with it safely. Woodside said it's also going to anticipate your needs, like firing up your camera before you even call up the app when you pull it out of your pocket. And the Moto X will have two processors inside for improved battery life. And then Motorola decided to release a press release saying that every Moto X sold in the U.S. will be assembled in the U.S. And they also dropped a release timeline of late summer. So this phone is coming pretty soon. Rafe, what are your impressions of the phone and Dennis Woodside just basically explaining this? Not a press conference, just kind of sitting there, just talking.
The phone that he wouldn't show anybody? Right. He said, yes, I have it in my pocket, but no, you can't see it. I think that what he's talking about, so Motorola and Google obviously can create this great context-aware phone, and Google is really pushing towards that now. Many developers are, but Google now is all about anticipating what you want. And the way that you do that in a smart device is by having sensors and intelligence, but sensors that know what the user is doing, whether they're moving in a car, if they're inside or they're outside, what their next appointment is, if they're, you know, running or sitting still, whatever. So the more sensors you have, the more you can anticipate what people want, the more cues you can pick up, just like I can pick up a cue from a person by their posture. So I think that the Android developers working hand in hand with the hardware developers really closely, and not just hand in hand like they have with HTC or Samsung or whomever, but hand in hand with their own developers to make a phone, an integrated phone, it could be really cool. It's going to be really scary, but it could be really cool to have a phone that kind of reads your mind.
Tom, what do you think about the hook of built in the U.S., or at least assembled in the U.S., because these the components themselves are still being created elsewhere, being shipped in, but they're going to be assembled in the U.S. What about that particular hook?
Yeah, remember when Apple said they're going to build a Mac here, they said it's not going to be just screwdriver assembly. We're going to have parts here as well, at least some of them. This is the opposite. This is saying we're going to assemble it in Texas. That actually might save them some money if it's not the exclusive place that it's created. They may actually be assembling it here and only selling it here, which might save them some shipping costs. Who knows? I mean, they still have to ship the parts over. But I'll be interested to see how that works out for them. I'm more excited about the stuff Rafe's talking about. That context awareness is going to be really fun if it works really well, because that's a differentiating factor that we really don't see in a lot of other phones.
It's probably important to note at I.O. actually, the part of the announcement of some of the new APIs that they're rolling out to developers is the activity recognition API, which does just this. So this is Google working, or Motorola rather, working with Google closely on this new API to kind of demonstrate exactly the power of something like this. Hopefully this is kind of a signal to other manufacturers of kind of the cool new things that you can do using this API to hopefully do things like save your battery and all that kind of stuff.
So is this going to come off as gimmicky, or is this going to be useful?
Oh, I think it'll be very useful. And I think that the technology of, you know, knowing what I'm going to do before I do it is really interesting, because, yeah, most of the time, if it works perfectly, it'll be like, oh, this is so helpful. Yeah, I didn't have to actually click on the camera icon because I was about to take a picture. But what, you know, what about this whole, like, power of suggestion thing, where I wasn't about to take a picture, but, oh, camera app is up now. Maybe I should. And maybe Google knows that I'm in a particular area where I might be taking a picture that Google would like me to take a picture of. See where this is going? All of a sudden, Google controls my mind.
I like where you're going with this. That's the way they could crowdsource Street View maps and all these other things. Because, like, oh, yeah, the camera's up. So, yes, you will take a picture inside this mall now.
Exactly. It's already open. I might as well just take a photo of this. Really,
they have to compete with Wiki Nearby or whatever that was from yesterday.
Yeah, that too. Although you have to kind of want to contribute to
Google
Wikipedia's
Image Search just got
nearby. If you're annotating articles.
Yeah, and I think one of the larger points is that this phone's going to be available, at least Woodside's claiming, broadly. So it's going not like Motorola in the past, where Droid was Verizon. Yeah. That was their flagship. If this device is available on multiple carriers and it does everything he says, it could be a pretty big hit. But it's that name. If it's called Moto X everywhere, kind of like what Samsung did, I think that'll help too. But if it's called the Moto 3 somewhere and the Moto X here and the Y there, it's going to cause confusion.
Also, they should change the ad campaign to Howdy Moto, because it's built in Texas. So no more Hello Moto thing. Google will now publicly disclose critical vulnerabilities that are being actively exploited after 7 days, down from 60. Now, it has to meet both those criteria. It has to be actively exploited. It has to be a critical vulnerability. Otherwise, they'll wait 60 days. This is because they're not getting the cooperation from some companies that they think they should get. And in their blog post, they said, each day, an actively exploited vulnerability remains undisclosed to the public and unpatched. More computers will be compromised. Google engineer Tavis Ormandy disclosed a publicly unknown zero-day vulnerability in Windows 7 and Windows 8 5 days after informing Microsoft of the bug. And Ormandy has done this sort of thing before. He's gotten in hot water for disclosure. If just so you know, Google is a big contributor to bug fixes for Windows. In Microsoft's Patch Tuesday in February, Google researchers uncovered more than half of the reported flaws. But it comes down to the old question, Rafe. We've been talking about this for years. If the hackers know and the people don't, is it incumbent to let the people know, or is it better to keep it under wraps so fewer people who are bad guys find out about it until a fix is ready?
Why are you asking me what the right time is? I mean, there is no right way to do this. When you've got a flaw in a system, if you release the information about that immediately, you're disclosing things, you're forcing people to make the updates to be aware of it. If you wait, then the hackers who might not be aware of this thing aren't taking advantage of it. So there is no right answer. I happen to think that about 7 days is about right, knowing the way developers work and how long it takes to move something through the cycle. That sounds like about the right thing. If we know about a problem, then you know we can turn it around right away. I am, and we are fans of transparency, of telling users what is going on with their products. I think that is the right thing to do. And I think from a business perspective, that is how you get trust, by being open with people. But, you know, bad guys don't play by the rules. So you want to give them as little information as possible. And there is no way to come up with the perfect balance for the one and the other.
Sarah, is it better to not know until there's a fix, or do you want to know that there's something out there you have to be aware of?
You want to know. You absolutely want to know. I mean, I can't, if there's some sort of a vulnerability that's affecting something that I'm using, I'm probably not equipped with the tools to fix it myself. But I think there are enough people out there who are, that the more we know, the more we at least have the power to say, okay, this exploit exists, so I can choose not to interact with something where somebody may be able to execute on it. You know, I know that there are exceptions to this, but in general, I feel like full disclosure as soon as possible is almost always the way to go.
As you agree. I mean, is 7 days enough for a company to at least come up with a workaround, if not a fix?
Well, 7 days for a large company, sure, because they should have engineers on this anyway. They probably are aware of the situation. So 7 days might also give, incentive to get this stuff done in six, because these exploits are out there and you want it fixed as soon as possible. Because if one person has discovered it, there's at least 100 people who know how to do this. So it's kind of giving incentive to get this fixed. But then again, it's not like Google's going to like publish it on the front page. You're not going to google.com and say, by the way, here's a giant exploit. So it's only the people who are searching for this are going to find this. So I don't know if it's necessarily time to freak out because, oh, Google's going to publish this.
Well, X phone's going to tell you about it.
Right. And the media will make hay of this. I mean, you know, Google doesn't have to say, hey, there's an exploit and send out to everybody, because the various publications that we all like will push that out there. And then the general media will pick it up. And then you get somebody on a local newscast saying, Google knows everything you're doing right now. You know, so this will probably increase paranoia levels a little bit. What? Maybe that'll make people better with security. So that's a net positive. Right.
All right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I am in favor of as much disclosure as possible. So I'm glad Google is doing this. But it's seven days to work up a workaround and prepare a fix. I think that's fair, especially in critical vulnerabilities that are known to be exploited. I think that's good, too. Let's go to something more fun, which is instant delivery of food.
Food. You don't have to leave your house. It's all about food. Yeah. So we talked a couple weeks ago about Seamless and Grubhub announcing that they are merging into one bigger food delivery company. In the case of Seamless, it's stuff other than food, but you know, it's big, and it's certainly big in markets like New York City, which is very densely populated, and you've got a lot of people who are used to food delivery. Postmates is another one of these food delivery services, which has already been live in San Francisco for, at least about a year. Seattle, I don't know, about 6 months ago. Now they've officially launched in New York City. To start, they're starting small. They're basically only in a 10-block radius from their headquarters in sort of the middle of Manhattan. So you can go, I don't know, anywhere between about 14th Street to 42nd Street. So it's not all of the five boroughs, but they are officially in New York City. And for the most part, Postmates CEO Bastian Lemon says that New York is ideal for bike couriers. Postmates is not all about bike couriers, but they certainly have a bike courier fleet in San Francisco. One of the issues that I've had is San Francisco, depending on where you live, your bike courier may have to be pedaling up and down some pretty crazy hills. And sometimes that's going to take a while. And sometimes if you've got hot food, by the time it gets to you, it's not hot anymore. Postmates says New York is flat and it's a grid and it can be a lot easier for bike couriers. They make money off delivery fees. They've sort of got a sliding scale depending on the difficulty of your order. So if you order one thing, it's obviously easier than if you order a large batch of items from, let's say, a Whole Foods and a bike courier has to get it to you. What's interesting about this and why I don't think that Postmates is just another Me Too, another place to order food, is that they're building their own items database for merchants. In fact, in the case of Whole Foods, I know that the Postmates team in San Francisco spent about 2 weeks taking photos and making inventory of everything that Whole Foods sells. I mean, that's thousands and thousands of items, to the point where, yes, a big company like Whole Foods probably has their own internal database, but different merchants who don't already have this information then can use Postmates as a place to take stock of their own inventory, to make changes to their menus online, that sort of thing. So it's a little bit of a, we're a food service, food delivery service, but we're also providing a service to merchants that might not already have that sort of thing built in. Rafe, what do you make of these food delivery services? Do you think Postmates has a leg up on the other guys for offering inventory as well as delivery?
In the 10-block radius they have, then yeah. I love the idea of a startup that is focusing on such a small little market. It's like all the delivery companies in India that are just, they're local, and that's how you do this. This is a definite ground war battle. The thing that I find very interesting about all the food pickup services is that there is no natural monopoly here. So if I wanted to come up with, you know, Rafe's delivery service tomorrow, because every takeout joint has a web connection, they can just be running all these different windows. It's like people right now who run multiple IM clients. And most, you know, a lot of people do. They'll run, even if they're not aware of it, they're running 3 or 4 IM clients. So you can run 3 or 4 delivery clients and just say, this one says deliver this to that person. This other client says deliver this to that person. So there, it's a very difficult business, and it has to be won on the ground, restaurant by restaurant. What I think has to happen is somewhere there's a middleware layer that has to be built. So if I'm opening a restaurant, instead of having to manage all these different relationships, there needs to be this centralized place where I manage my menus or my store inventory, and that goes out to all these different services. And I think that is where the opportunity is. I think the ground war of doing the deliveries is just a pain in the neck, and it's going to be a margin business and a very difficult one to win on, no matter how big you are right now.
Ayaz, do you think that having so many different players in a food delivery market, and, you know, it sounds so silly saying that out loud, but it's true. Do you think that ends up hurting the merchants? Because they, you know, you either say, okay, well, I'm going to work with everybody and then let the customer decide which service they like the best, or I have to choose one and then risk the customer that I have not being familiar with the courier service that I might have chosen.
I'm not sure what actual risk is going to happen in the actual execution of this. If there is some exclusive deals, I think that could be problematic for merchants. But this idea, when you were talking about Postmates and taking these pictures of inventory and making their own databases, I think that's going to help Postmates in general, because you have this uniform experience. Because sometimes you have these services that kind of are the middleman, but they are kind of like almost like an iframe. So you have this little thing above an interface that changes as you go from vendor to vendor. By having this kind of this inventory system of their own, at least when you go into it, you can have this consistent experience. I think that's going to set them apart from other places. I know I used to use something like delivery.com in New York City all the time, because they were one location for all of the things I wanted to see. But this just, I'm really glad these guys are making money on the delivery fees, because otherwise this would be Cosmo all over again. And I miss Cosmo, because I used to use that all the time. There's a 1-hour delivery for pretty much anything you wanted if you've never heard of that before.
Well, I'm flying to New York tomorrow, and I'm gonna do a courier service to the death. I'm gonna time everybody, and I'm gonna see how quickly I get that piece of pizza, and is it cold?
It's the one that makes it easy to order. Yeah. In other words, I could see the food. I know I'm going to get food, and actually works well with the restaurants. So the restaurants are actually paying attention to what they're saying and what they're promising. I think that's the one that wins. You know, JD.com in China is featured in Mary Meeker's 2013 Internet Trends slides, because one of the things they do in like over 100 cities, more than 100 cities, they do instant delivery. It's not quite instant, but, you know, less than 24-hour delivery of items that you buy online. And they're sort of an eBay-ish, Amazon-ish marketplace. Tons of Internet Trends coming out of Mary Meeker's slides. And of course, poor Lang Wu over there at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield Byers helped with this. He doesn't quite get the attention in the headlines that Mary does, because she's famous for this. 117 slides. We're not going to go through all of it. A lot of stuff about mobile, about the gap in monetization. So whenever you hear people saying, yeah, but nobody's making money off mobile, they're going to. There's a $20 billion gap that's going to get closed there. Mobile traffic is now 15% of the internet, 1.5 times growth per year. Tablets growing much faster than previous product categories. That's actually one that's really interesting. And according to one of her slides, it looks like Android is really stealing market share from Windows not other mobile platforms. If you look at the graph, you can see Android growing as Windows starts to decrease because she includes all operating systems in one graph there. And a lot of stuff about China. China users spend more time on mobile and internet than the United States. We still spend a lot more time on TV. There are more Android and iOS users in China than in the United States. That's as of the first month of this year. But where I started to turn my head was with wearables. She has a slide that shows mainframes were the 60s, mini computers the 70s, personal computers the 80s, desktop computers the 90s, mobile the first decade of this century, and we're getting to wearable. The next cycle is wearables, drivables, flyables, and scannables. Pointing out QR codes, huge in China, 400 million users, four times year-over-year growth. WeChat is one of those that makes use of QR codes. We've talked about them a lot. And users reach for their phone 150 times a day, mostly for messaging, making calls, and checking the time. If you've got a wearable, that makes it easier to do that. So Rafe, I mean, we all know that wearable is the trend. Do these slides confirm that, change your opinion one way or the other?
You know, Mary Meeker put up 117 slides in her presentation, which is, I didn't see it, but my guess was like, because I've seen her do it a couple other times, like 20 minutes. It's kind of hard to process that much information that fast. But we do believe, I believe that wearables, or as Aya says, lunchables, snackables, I mean, that's probably the thing she left out, eatable technology, is what's happening. The Google Glass is clunky and socially awkward, but that's the beginning of a very important trend, which is the technology is part of you. Whether it anticipates what you want to do, whether it's on your wrist and it's just at a glance, or whether it's, you know, projected into your eyeballs, that is where it's happening. And it's not so much about that you that it's a different user interface. It is that it is the one that binds everything together. So the thing that you are wearing or the thing that is on your body knows what other stuff you're interacting with. And all of a sudden, because of that, they can all start to work together in ways that we haven't seen before. So there's a whole lot of opportunity there.
Ayaz, what do you think? You're usually the one to be a little more skeptical than the rest of us about the trends. You ready to embrace the wearable?
I don't know if I'm skeptical, but I like the wearable technology concepts in general. It's just the execution has been kind of lousy in general because we have an issue with battery life. We have issues with communications. Bluetooth was supposed to solve some of this. You had this personal area network, right? You had your phone. You had your earpiece. You'd have maybe a keyboard and mouse that can connect to your phone. And sometimes those things don't work so well. So it's really about getting these devices to really talk to each other in a power-efficient way. And I think that Bluetooth 4.0 is supposed to help that. Wi-Fi Direct is supposed to allow more data transfer at a faster rate than you could get with Bluetooth. So wearables, I think, at this point, they probably have their best chance. Kind of like tablets got redesigned with the iPad. Tablets were around. They just didn't have the right use case scenario. They didn't have the right operations. But with the new technologies, I think there's a better chance of it taking off. But it does require everything working together, and we know how companies love making sure their stuff isn't interoperable with other manufacturers.
Sarah, she lumps in drivable with this and shows off the Google car, talks about Pandora being listened. She shows flyable with drones, not for military uses, but for public safety, for sports and entertainment, for agriculture, and scannables. I mentioned that briefly, all of these QR codes, you can quickly scan smartphone info, get info on nutrition when you're shopping, get price info, and boarding passes, tickets, all that sort of thing. This all seems spot on to me. What about you?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's almost like the trend is going back to there are a variety of devices that don't do everything. They do certain things really well. You know, we're used to like digital cameras. Well, who needs a digital camera anymore? Because everything's in your smartphone. It does it all. Okay, but you can't have everything, you know, on a wristwatch because the screen size is maybe a little bit too small. A drone doesn't necessarily need to be clipping stuff to Evernote while it's in the air, but maybe taking pictures of what's down below is going to be helpful. Self-driving car, you know, what does it have to do? It has to make sure it doesn't run into other cars and maybe play some Pandora music for you. So I like the idea of devices kind of cutting out, trimming the fat, right? Like do the stuff that you need it to do depending on how it's built. Are you wearing it? Are you sitting in it? you know, is it flying in the air type of a thing. So it's not really, it's not like we're going back to the way things were, but it's kind of an evolution again of more devices that do fewer things.
The thing that we have to think about is where are our applications? Are we using an application on our phone, in our car, on our TV? Is that the way we're going to be thinking about things 5 years from now, or is it just going to be Pandora and not the planet, but Pandora? I'm sitting in my living room in front of my great stereo system, or Pandora, I'm in the car, or Pandora, I'm running and I got my headphones in. We're not going to think about which app I pull up. We're just going to think about, oh, I am a user of this service, and I want it to do what I want it to do on the screen or the device that makes the most sense at that exact moment. So it requires us to think about how we build products in different ways, and the intelligence of them being more distributed, more cloudified, maybe more centralized, depending on how you look at it, than they are right now. And I think that's I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because I think it puts some pressure for, if not openness, at least for cross-platform compatibility when you have all these different things. Who are you wearing? My Facebook friends will be the answer. let's move on to the random box. High school student Justin Beckerman has made his own single-person submarine. He had $2,000 to blow on it, apparently, and it took him 6 months to build. The window's an old skylight. The regulators and gauges are from an old soda fountain. And he can spend about 2 hours in the lake searching around. He wants to find the cannons from his neighbor's historic house that were dumped in the lake a long time ago.
The suit, it's more like a suit. It kind of looks like the robot from Lost in Space.
Yeah, he does. It's like a suit for walking around underwater. But it's breathable. He's got ballast tanks. He can bring oxygen down from the surface. Like, pretty amazing DIY stuff, don't you think?
That's so cool.
Is this a part of a trend?
He's going to become a smuggler. You said all this money to blow. Where do you think how do you think he's going to fund that thing?
He's going to find a cannon and sell it on eBay.
Uh-huh.
Or something. I don't know.
Cross-border transportation.
Yeah. Let's see what's on the calendar.
The BlackBerry Q10 pre-orders have begun, and it has an official release date. It'll be coming to Verizon on June 6th, 2013.
So not put that on your 2014 calendar, because it's on ours.
Put that on your calendar and smoke it. No, you can't do that.
Don't smoke your calendar. No. You won't be able to check it anymore. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We got an email from Patrick. He says, I don't see Sony exiting the electronics market quickly. If they're really smart, they'll manage the risk by selling off the movie and insurance businesses to separate corporate entities and let the electronics business make or break itself alone. The Sony brand has long represented top quality, but also one of the most expensive vendors in the consumer electronics marketplace. Apple suffers from the same kind of problem because there are lots of people who refuse to pay top dollar for any product, even if it is arguably the best. They'd rather pay 50% off top dollar and feel like they got a good deal. Like Apple, Sony kept the high end of the market, which has now collapsed due to the economy, so it's obvious that they need to reestablish their brand superiority in the average price range of the market for a while, then upsell people on features and novelty later on.
Well, Patrick makes a good point about what a strategy Sony could take, but as far as whether they keep the electronics business and sell off the others or vice versa, doesn't really matter. I mean, they'll probably both get a chance to use whatever brands they're using, whether they're spun out or they spin each other out. It ends up being the same thing, kind of. Well, that is it for this episode of Tech News Today. Rafe Needleman, thank you so much for joining us.
Always good to be here, Tom. Good to see you guys.
You know, I want to give you a chance to talk about that the new features you got from Evernote over there.
Well, there's a couple of new things. Obviously, you know, the two-step verification is new, and we encourage premium users to give it a shot to increase the security of their account. It's a good way to protect your data should your password get compromised. We also recently rolled out reminders, which are really cool. I don't know if you guys have talked about those yet. So you can now take a note in Evernote and flag it as a reminder, and it'll or you can pin it to your list of notes, or set a date on it, and it'll come back with an email, you know, on the date you specify, saying this note that you flagged is now due, and remind you of stuff. If you've got, like me, you know, thousands, literally thousands and thousands of notes, it's good to be able to have them come back to you when you want them to. So those are two new, cool new things that I think are worth checking out.
So keep up with you at opnotes.com, O-P-P-N-O-T-E-S.
Yep, the column opportunity notes. Now that I'm doing developer relations stuff here, I'm going to be writing less. So just go to evernote.com or blog.evernote.com for all the cool stuff that's happening on to the product and the various other products that Evernote does, like food and Sketch and Hello.
Thanks, man. Really good to have you back on the show. Always good, to be good here. Time.
Thanks.
You can help us create our show, folks. TechNewsToday.reddit.com is our subreddit. You can submit stories. You can vote on stories. It's one of the things we look at every day to figure out what we're going to talk about. Your votes do matter. Go to TechNewsToday.reddit.com and express them. Coming up this Wednesday, June 12th, at 4 or 4:30, we're going to nail down the time exactly, but we're going to do a hangout, me and Jason and Sarah and Iaz, to just kind of brainstorm with the audience about Tech News Today, what you like about it, any new ideas, improvements, et cetera. So keep on the lookout for more details about that coming up Wednesday, June 12th. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, or give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. It's Friday tomorrow. We'll have Darren Kitchen and Len Peralta illustrating the stories. We'll see you then.